For our Thanksgiving week session of the Hoover History Working Group, we were very lucky to get Ike Fryman to come on to talk about his new book, One Belt, One Road, Chinese Power Meets the World. It was especially pleasurable for me as Ike is a former student of mine from his Harvard undergraduate days. Since then, he's gone on, of course, to greater things. He actually did 2 degrees at Harvard, an AM in Asian Studies after his AB in East Asian History. And then he went on to the University of Cambridge, where he was a Henry Scholar in the master's program there. Right now, he's writing up his DPhil in China Studies at the University of Oxford. So Ike, welcome to Hoover. The book is fascinating. It takes a very new and I think original look at One Belt, One Road. And let me start by asking you to explain a little bit the kind of applied history of Xi Jinping, because it seems to me that part of what you're telling us is that the Chinese government, and in particular its leader, knows very well how to use history for propaganda purposes.
Well, thank you, Neil. One Belt, One Road is as a bit of a cipher, as thoroughly as it has been discussed in the media in many languages. 7 years after it was announced, experts can't decide. Is it primarily an infrastructure and development and financing program? Is it a domestic economic program to offload China's excess capacity in the state sector and dump it in foreign markets? Or is it some sort of grand strategic plan to take over Eurasia and thereby the world? My book comes to the conclusion that it is all of these things, but in a sense, it is none of them, because at its heart, One Belt, One Road is a political or ideological campaign to organize the Chinese party state around Xi Jinping. It entails a whole-scale rewriting of the history of the ancient Silk Road, and it seeks to bring Xi Jinping's contribution into juxtaposition with that of Han Udi, the great emperor of the second and first centuries BC, widely regarded as the greatest emperor in Chinese history. So essentially, this is a story about Xi Jinping trying to carve out a space for himself in the Chinese historical pantheon and rallying the party state from the grassroots on up in order to fulfill that goal.
Would you say then that this is a case of the primacy of domestic politics, that what's really driving this is Xi's desire to legitimize his own rule that he's, of course, extended indefinitely, and that the kind of foreign economic consequences are secondary to these domestic considerations?
To a large extent, yes. I mean, it's worth remembering. One Belt, One Road, as most people understand it, refers to a model of infrastructure financing. So essentially, a Chinese state bank or policy bank will approach a recipient country and say, hey there, if you'd like to build this road or port or airport or other piece of infrastructure, we will supply you a loan at generally a reasonably favorable rate of interest. And you can then contract with a Chinese construction company to go and make that happen on a favorable timeline. Now, this was not a model that Xi Jinping invented. In fact, when he came to power in 2013, hundreds of billions of dollars worth of such projects were already under construction all around the world, including the famous Chinese port of Hambantota. So you could argue that Xi Jinping was simply trying to carve out his own space and to take credit for a lot of stuff that had been initiated by his predecessors. But certainly, since the direction of travel has been to more Chinese FDI rather than less under Xi Jinping, there has been an effort to flex China's muscles overseas, but to do so under the aegis of an initiative that, to his domestic audience, is understood as his own.
In his most recent book, Michael Pettis draws on the historiography of British imperialism and dredges up the name of J.A. Hobson and his theory of underconsumption as the basis for British overseas expansion. Is there a place for this kind of analysis in your account of One Belt, One Road?
Absolutely. I mean, Michael Pettis' work is excellent. China, since the early 2000s, but particularly post global financial crisis has been hooked on a debt finance model of development. Consumption is weak, and one of the features we've seen of China's economic rebound since the COVID crisis has been consumption is not carrying the growth. They need to take out more and more debt in order to finance each additional unit of GDP. So in a sense, yes, China has developed One Belt, One Road into a mechanism for exporting that model elsewhere. But I also think it is a story has to do with excess capacity in the Chinese system. It has to do with Chinese enterprises' willingness to take losses in order to please the center. So I think there is a political as well as a macroeconomic element to this. And that ultimately is what my book is trying to unpack.
In the course of the seminar that we had at Hoover, you were asked to talk a little bit about resistance to One Belt, One Road, both domestically and abroad. So talk a little bit about the opposition that it's elicited.
Well, there's been all manner of opposition to One Belt, One Road. Within China, insofar as it's a political or ideological revisionist exercise to render Xi Jinping as a new emperor, anyone who disapproves of what he's done to Chinese institutions is not going to approve of it. And a great many people on the left of the party who believe that more money should be spent in reconciling contradictions in China's own domestic economy, doing anti-poverty programs, developing the interior West, and so forth, think it's wrong that Chinese enterprises should be directed to waste large amounts of money overseas. But the direct criticism has been muted. If you attend Track 2 dialogues, if you speak to Chinese friends in private, particularly outside of China, they'll often be vocally opposed. But inside, this has become so personalized to Xi Jinping that they daren't criticize it for fear of political suppression. Overseas, there's been all manner of opposition, ranging from speeches in national parliaments to protests at actual project sites. And this is real. And in some countries like the Maldives, we've actually seen countries that have interacted with the Belt and Road turn away. But one of the things that I find doing research on four continents is that this is the exception, not the norm. Belt and Road is offering a fundamentally attractive value proposition to the elites who wield the power in many of these recipient countries. And so the longer term direction of travel tends to be, despite whatever opposition you'll see on the local level, towards closer elite ties to Beijing.
You just mentioned the fact that you've done research in four continents, and it reminded me of the great historian of the French Revolution, Richard Cobb, who used to say that the most important research was done with the feet. Tell us a little bit about some of your adventures in search of the new Silk Road, or however we now describe it.
Well, I got stuck in the mud in Sri Lanka. I broke into several projects, put myself in danger. I visited Tanzania on a tourist visa when I was conducting decidedly untouristy research, and did all sorts of risks that, as I've gotten older, I've come to appreciate were probably unwise. I think one of the biggest difficulties in putting together the book was trying to think ahead and understand who I could be potentially putting in danger. I was helped by all kinds of people on the ground, from local guides, construction workers who talked to me, local level officials, up to people in the prime minister's offices. But the political environment in particularly developing countries can change quickly. And giving a quote to a student or a journalist might be one thing in one year and something very different the next. So I had to make a lot of painful cuts, a lot of choices to anonymize people who I wish I could have cited directly. But I'm grateful to everyone who took risks. One thing I learned is that in basically no part of the world, even in developed countries in the heart of Europe, does it pay to be an archivist, a librarian, or a local official who helps a researcher.
Amen to that. And one last question, which really relates to your next book. You're working as part of your DPhil at Oxford on China's Arctic ambitions. Tell us a bit about that next project, and have you been to Greenland yet?
I have not been to Greenland. Their borders are closed because of COVID. But I do think that the Arctic is growing up to be an extremely important zone of U.S.-China competition. The Chinese have identified the Arctic as one of the strategic new domains alongside cyberspace, outer space, and the deep sea, which are essentially a category of space in which China thinks that it can, if it pushes hard enough, play a role in rewriting the rules of governance of that domain in order to secure Chinese interests. The Arctic is important because it is going to be transformed over the next few decades by melting ice, even if the world stops emitting tomorrow. So at the same time as the Biden administration is going to be debating re-entering the Paris Accords and so forth, the US and China are shaping up to be conducting a Cold War style superpower competition. And the big difference is they'll be doing it on a changing planet, where the anticipation of future climate change is going to force all manner of geopolitical realignments. And the scramble for Greenland, which is played out in secret, which burst into the public eye in 2018, is, I think, only the first of many. So hopefully by getting in on the ground floor, I can better understand what this mechanism is and help shape the conversation about US-China and the climate challenge.
Well, Ike, the best of luck with the DPhil. Congratulations on the book. Once again, the title of Ike Fryman's new book, One Belt, One Road, Chinese Power Meets the World, published by Harvard University Press and available at all good bookstores and, of course, on Amazon. Ike, thanks so much for joining the Hoover History Working Group, and we look forward to reading the next book soon.
Thank you, Neil. Appreciate you having me.